speaker of the morning. Dan Sinhas is going to speak to us on new perspectives on self-blame.
Thank you. First, wanted to mention that we're passing around what will be on these slides. I tend to put a lot of slides, so to preempt any audience revolt, it's to keep me from taking them off. You sort of have what will be up in front of you, so please don't leave and just read them. I'll try to make it worth your while. I wanted to thank the organizers for inviting me. I want to just say, sort of at a personal level, it's a fun setting, not only because I'm now a sort of local for the Cascade seminar, but because one of the first things I did in topology as an undergrad was implement a computer program to compute the Jones polynomial. And that was when I was an undergrad at MIT. And at the time, you know, there was this question, especially around MIT, you had all these invariants coming from representation theory and Lie algebras and ideas from physics and skein theory, and the question is, you know, what do these mean in sort of good old-fashioned terms, topology that we grew up on? And so I kept that question with me and learned some algebraic topology, and then when I was finishing as a graduate student, I saw Tom Goodwillie speak, and he had some ideas that blended algebraic topology and knot theory, and I was fortunate to get a postdoc with him. And in this talk, I'll sort of report the progress, and there's a fair amount of progress on actually that question. How can we understand these sort of finite type invariants, at least of knots? Of course, the theory also applies to three manifolds and other elsewhere in geometric topology, but how can we understand those structures in terms of more classical, quote-unquote, topology? So we're going to be talking about, in general, embeddings of an interval in M, so knots in a general manifold. And for technical reasons, the kind of knot theory I like to do is for manifolds with boundary. So here's my M, and there's a couple special points on the boundary and a couple tangent vectors at those points. And my knot must start out at one and sort of end up going into the other. So, and what we're going to do is we're going to look at the space of all such knots. And again, one of the cases we care most about is when M is Euclidean space cross an interval. We sort of recover classical knot theory, and the question we want to know there is, how can we understand the components of this space? Okay, so that's just a fancy formulation of understanding isotopy classification of knots. But it's useful to look at this, and in fact Vasiliev looked at this special case pi naught of the space of embeddings of an interval in arc 2 cross I is a special case of a general embedding problem looking at the space of knots. In higher dimensions, of course, all knots are isotopic, but you can look at families. There can be non-trivial families. You can have a 2 spheres worth of knots in R4, which doesn't extend to a 3 balls worth of knots in R4. So that's the kind of moduli problem you're looking at. As I said, Goodwillie's ideas are going to play a strong role, and it's and so another part of the motivation is to just understand what those ideas say in this very concrete setting. So Goodwillie's calculus is something that many different algebraic topologists are trying to get their minds around, and this is a nice setting to do so. Okay, so the main thrust of this is going to be that all these ideas, finite type invariants and the Goodwillie calculus, have a very concrete geometric construction at their related to them, namely the evaluation map. So let's go back, and instead of understanding finite type invariants, let's start with the linking number. Okay, it's well known that the linking number is of a two-component link is of finite type. And if I've got such a two-component link, then what I can do is define an evaluation map. That is a map from a torus to a two-sphere. What you do is you take one point on the first component, one point on the second component. So that's determined by a point on the torus. And Oh, it's down there. All right, let me put it up here. So I've got my link here. And what I do is I take one point on the first component, one point on the second component, and that's, you know, determined by a point on the torus, of course, a pair of points on the circle. And so what you do is you take the unit vector between them. That's well defined because they're distinct, because we had a link. And that gives you a map from the torus to S2. And you can define linking number as in various ways, but the sort of what I think of the most basic way is it's the homotopy class of that map. You can then say that a good invariant of that homotopy class is the degree on the second homology. And, of course, you could evaluate that degree using de Rham theory, and if you do, and you use the standard round form in S2, you get Gauss's definition of linking number. But you could also sort of take a limit of forms on S2 which are more and more concentrated, and what you would find is a crossing change or counting formula depending on how, if you concentrate it at one or two points. And that's very combinatorial and skein theoretic. So, well, for finite type invariants, there's similar ways to understand them to most of these. The Vasiliev's original definition, you know, he was looking at spaces of knots, but ultimately he was thinking about sort of walls between spaces of knots and what happens when you cross through walls. And what happens when you cross through a wall is just a crossing change. So even though his techniques were couched in the language of topology, at the end of the day, people realized, you know, Berman and Lin in particular, that the key was the sort of the fact that you had this finite... The finiteness to the crossing formulas. So, but then the question of realization came up, and as many people in this room know, Kontsevich solved that spectacularly, and the Kontsevich and the Bott-Taubes integrals can be looked at as direct generalizations of the Gauss integral for linking number. Okay. And as far as degree theory, well, you get a degree theory only over Q, though, so it's maybe not the most... you know, you like to have degree theory over the integers, but there has been a degree theory interpretation of these invariants as well due to Cooperberg and Dylan Thurston. But this sort of interpretation has been missing, until I hope to convince you that that we have it now, that there is a sort of good homotopy class definition for finite type invariants of knots. Okay, certainly rationally, and we're starting to get integral information, which is something that you don't have by those other methods. Okay, so let me also note a beautiful piece of work that I don't think is well known. Koshorka showed that you could get all higher linking invariants, all of the Milner-Mu invariants, through looking at the homotopy class of evaluation map instead of. Just an evaluation map from a 2-torus, you look at evaluation map from an n-torus into a configuration space. And he did some basic homotopy theory and showed that you can define all mu invariants that way. And it's one of my favorite results because I had sort of thought for a while, I mean, the mu invariants are described by this module Li-N, has to do with sort of basics of Li brackets. And so are certain homotopy groups of wedges of spheres. Well, it actually turns out that that's not an accident. Koshorka's work relates the two directly. It's a nice piece of work, and it's nice to understand. Okay, so let's try to define this evaluation map for knots. Naively, you could say, I mean, you want to take advantage of the fact that a knot does not intersect itself globally or locally. So the fact that it doesn't self-intersect locally is just the... immersion condition that the derivative doesn't vanish. So you could take distinct times in an interval and evaluate the knot at those times, and the point is that your image would be in this configuration space, the same configuration space Sergei was defining for us yesterday. So that's fine, and you could also take advantage of the fact that the derivative doesn't vanish by instead of looking at, so we think of points in C and M as just a configuration in M. Well, this space here is a configuration but with a unit tangent vector everywhere. Okay? And the point is that if you have a knot that goes along here, you can evaluate it at those points and get three distinct points and tangent vectors at those points. So you'd have a naive evaluation map from the interior of this simplex to this configuration space. And you would want to, say, look at its homotopy class in the case of knots. But there's an obvious problem. This space of maps is, well, it's not quite contractible, but it's just has the same homotopy type as this. The simplex is a contractible space. So somehow you'd want to fix boundary. But we don't have a boundary on the open simplex. Okay. So, I mean, the point is here again, the space of maps from an interval into X sort of isn't very interesting. It's only more or less interesting as X itself because you can squeeze an interval. But the space of maps from an interval into X with the boundary points fixed, that's the loop space, and that's a much more interesting construction. So you want to, somehow the feeling is that you should fix the boundary. I mean, people like Bott and Sullivan had this feeling for a while. And it was even known what kind of boundary you should put. I mean, of course, one boundary you could put on this simplex is a standard one. But somehow the natural evaluation map, then you would no longer sort of have the configuration space as the target. You would have m to the n, because you're allowing times to be the same, and therefore you're allowing the points in the image to be the same. So you want to keep the target somehow as configurations, but put a boundary on this. And the natural way to do that is to use the Fulton-McPherson compactifications. Okay. So the Fulton-McPherson compactifications, and I'm emphasizing this is a spherical version as opposed to the projective version that I'm going to talk about. First of all, up to homeomorphism, it's pretty easy to understand what the homeomorphism type of the compactifications are. I mean, the schematic is that here's m to the n, and you're taking away this, and if m was Euclidean, you're taking away a plane arrangement. Otherwise, you're taking away what's called the fat diagonal. So this is, for example, where xi is equal to xj. Well, this compactification is up to homeomorphism is instead of removing these guys, you're removing a tubular neighborhood of all of them. So that's pretty easy, and then you do get, if you remove an open tubular neighborhood, you do have something nice and compact. But the problem is that, of course, as a compactification, you want your space to naturally sit inside your compactification, for one thing. And there's all sorts of other properties that this Fulton-McPherson compactification has that this construction wouldn't give you. So up to homeomorphism, you can just look at this construction, but the construction, the better construction is a little more subtle. And it has things like good functorality properties, a nice manifolds with corner structure, good diagonal maps between them. So you don't think of configuration spaces having diagonal maps. Diagonal maps would take one point in the configuration and double it. But with this compactification, you do. You have diagonal maps, which, remember, those are used to define cup products and things, so those are nice to define. So let me list some properties before giving you the definition. It's a manifold with corners and thus naturally stratified. Topologically, it's just a manifold with boundary, of course. There is an inclusion, so you think of this space as being this space with a bunch of points at infinity. Just, again, classically, if you think projective space used to be just affine space with some points at infinity, right? That's all we're doing. We're adding some points at infinity to this space. There's also a projection from this space onto M to the N, and it's onto, which extends this inclusion. Okay, so if you've got a point in this space, you can actually produce N points in M where that configuration lies. Some of them in this sort of degenerate configuration might lie at the same points over M. That's okay. We're going to still have the same homotopy type. Let's see. And it is functorial for embeddings, which is going to be important for us. Because remember, we want our evaluation map. That's going to be the functorality. Okay. So let me define them for you now. And this is different from Fulton McPherson and Axelrod Singer's definition. Someone now tells me that Kinsevich had a similar definition, but didn't write it up. So I'm writing this definition up presently. First of all, let's define a map where we take a configuration of endpoints in RK and just look at the ith and jth points and take the unit vector between them. That's this map from CNRK to SN minus 1. That's a map when you pull back the generating class in the top cohomology of SK minus 1, you get those EIJ classes that Sergey defined for us yesterday. So this map has been behind the scenes in a previous talk. So that's a familiar map. What may be less familiar is, given a configuration of endpoints in RK, look at the points I, J, and K, and just take the ratio of this length divided by that length. Or, let's see, I, J, I, K, sorry. This length divided by that length. Okay, that's a map from configuration space to an interval, and it, of course, maps to the open interval, but I'm going to compactify the interval and just think of the closed interval from 0 to infinity. Okay, so what we can do is, this AKN is a space which CNRK maps to via these maps. On the first factor, this is just the canonical inclusion. Again, the configuration space is just this Euclidean space minus some subspaces. And that's already an inclusion. Therefore, the product of that map with any other maps is an inclusion. So we're going to include this in the product of that Euclidean space with these spheres with this interval. And we're just going to take the closure. So that's the definition. We're taking the closure of this subspace of that. And that's how we're adding the points at infinity. Okay? So, again, the standard construction uses blow-ups. This is slightly more elementary. You just use sort of classical geometry to find a space in which you're going to take the closure. Okay. Sorry. Oh, maybe I should use the pointer if that's... Thanks. Then I can work up here. So that's for Euclidean space. For a general manifold M, you embed it in a Euclidean space, and then you can still define those alpha, the pi ijs and the sijks, and take the closure, and that will be the compactification. Of course, you want to know whether it's independent of that embedding, and it is, so that's something to prove. But it is independent of the embedding, and you get a compactification of configurations of M. The nice thing is, notice that we take the closure inside M to the M, cross this, cross that. So if M was compact, the closure of some space in this, well, this is compact, is itself going to be compact. So that's why it's a compactification. Note in this case, it's sort of a slight misnomer. The closure of this in this is not compact, but it's no more or less compact than RK was to begin with. So it's not a true compactification. It's some sort of completion. All right. We need a technical variant for what I do, because we're looking at knots with points on the boundary of a manifold. If you've got a manifold with boundary and two distinguished points, you define a compactification relative to those two points as a subspace of configurations of n plus 2 points, where the zeroth point in the, or the first point in the configuration is one of your fixed points on the boundary, and the last point in the configuration is the other fixed point on the boundary. Okay, so those are, you're just looking at configurations of n plus 2 points where two of them are always chosen. So, so let me give an example, and then you start seeing how these compactifications work. If M, let me put that other slide up. Okay. If M is an interval and the boundary is the, you know, 0 and 1, then if I look at two points, well, first of all, if I look at one point compactified, you just get the interval. If I look at two points, Well, we're compactifying. Well, what are we compactifying? We're compactifying, first of all, space that splits up into two components, depending on whether the first point is less than or greater than the other one. So let me just focus on one of those components, say the one where they come in order. So what I'm doing is I'm compactifying an open simplex, right? Or basically an open simplex. What I end up getting is a pentagon. That's the compactification of the open simplex. In the interior, say my coordinates were t1 and t2, those were my two points in the interval, then what are the coordinates here? Well, over here, say t2 equals 1, so a good coordinate would be t1, okay, to use for these points on the boundary. And the same down here, t1 equals 0, so a good coordinate would be t2. Over here, this is simple enough, t1 equals t2, so we're just sort of adding points like that. The interesting things are on what's happening at these edges. I have a sequence of points, and look at and suppose it's convergent in this pentagon. How will I determine where on this edge I go? Well, you take the limit as O of t2 over t1, say, limit of that ratio, and that gives you sort of an interval's worth of choices to go here. Similarly, on this edge, you take the limit of 1 minus t2 over 1 minus t1. Maybe I wanted t1 over t2 here, but it doesn't matter. Okay? So these compactifications are giving additional data as sort of points in the configuration come together. Okay? I don't know. I'm not sure. I think this is, this is a coordinate description. By the way, you start seeing that this is a stratified space, and it's there's a couple ways to see it. I like to draw trees and say that this point is naturally labeled by a tree like this, and this point by a tree like this, and this point by a tree like that, etc. And this pentagon, some people might be familiar, think pentagon, first thing when you think pentagon is associativity. And that's true in general. So the general fact is that this compactification of the interval when we're looking at the boundary points is otherwise known as A in the nth Stasheff polytope or nth associahedron. And the correspondence there is as points are sort of clumping together and equal, you sort of keep track of that. So here's a picture of A3. So this is what the next compactification looks like. It's got four large pentagonal faces, two small pentagonal faces, so four large pentagonal faces, three rectangular faces, which are blow-ups of edges, and two small pentagonal faces, which are blow-ups of vertices. Okay, so let's see.
It's a disjoint union of a bunch of copies of that.
Right. Yeah. So one component is that. Thank you. So you get those Stasheff polytopes appearing again, which is a lovely story. In general, what happens, let me say, in general, the geometry of the points you're adding at infinity works as follows. Let me draw the picture and then explain how it relates to this. So again, we're adding points to the boundary. That means that what I can do to understand a point on the boundary is look at some sequence which converges to it once I'm in this compactification. So here's some sequence in C6M. So what's happening is you've got these 3 points. They're not doing much, but then these 3 points are coming together. And in the limit, what you end up getting is basically an element of C4M with what I call an infinitesimal configuration of 3 points in M. So what's an infinitesimal configuration? Well, the space of infinitesimal configurations is just the space of I distinct points in the tangent bundle of M, all in the same fiber, modulo translation and scaling in that fiber. Okay, so that's an infinitesimal configuration, just configuration in the tangent bundle, but we quotient by translation and scaling. So for example, if I've got 2 points in the tangent bundle of M, and they're all in the same tangent space, well, then up to translation, I can make one of them zero. And then up to scaling, I make the other a unit vector, and I get precisely the unit tangent bundle. Okay? And you know, 3 points doesn't have a similarly nice description, but it's not a bad space. The codimension one strata are always what you get. So notice I said what you get here is sort of a point in the infinitesimal configuration space and a point in the honest configuration space, and the point in the infinitesimal configuration space sits over one of the points in that configuration. That's precisely giving me a point in the pullback here. So some of the strata, the biggest strata you see, have this property that the limit points have this geometry of a configuration degenerating until a few points crash together, but you can sort of reconstruct what happens in the crash. And again, if we look at this definition here, we can start see that we've got the kind of data we need to reconstruct that infinitesimal configuration. For the most part, all I need is these vectors. If I've got points coming together in Euclidean space, then, and I look at these vectors between them, then again, this is a compact space. Let's just project this onto that factor. This is a compact space. Their limit is just going to be some unit vectors. That's enough, you know, by the angle theorem in high school or something like that, to reconstruct the sort of similarity class of triangle and orientation of that triangle in space. That's true for almost all collections of 3 points, except when the 3 points are collinear. And in that case, you need this sort of data coming from this factor to reconstruct the infinitesimal configuration. So I think you can start to see now how this definition and this sort of basic intuition coincide a bit. Okay. What happens in higher codimension strata is either a couple different things. Either you could have 3 points coming together over here and 2 points coming together over here. Or you have 3 points coming together, but maybe you don't get an infinitesimal configuration in the limit because two of them are approaching much faster than the third. So one's approaching at a z speed and one's approaching at a z squared speed. But then what you can do is you can sort of nest it. You only see 2 points here, but then when I look at one of them closely, I realize that that's the product of two other points which have crashed. And you get all the higher codimensional strata that way. And again, it's the fun combinatorics that lets you keep track of these things are sort of labeled trees. You know, each vertex corresponds to some collision. Okay. Any questions on the compactifications? Yes?
You consider these points as distinguished points. You don't mod out by symmetric group.
Yeah, I don't mod out by the symmetric group, although this construction is equivariant, so you could if you'd like. So, I mean, I'm sure for some applications you'd want to use the fact that the construction is equivariant. Let me getting back to the main story. One thing I didn't like about the naive compactification of the simplex is that the natural target was M to the N, which has a different homotopy type than the configuration space. Well, these compactifications, they're manifolds with corners, which means they're topological manifolds with boundaries. Their interiors are just the open configuration space, and it's just a basic fact that by some sort of coloring that a topological manifold with boundaries, homotopy equivalent to its interior. So we're not destroying the homotopy type by adding these points at infinity, and that's going to be a nice fact, because, well, I personally love the topology of configuration spaces. Okay, so now I'm ready to state the main foundational results. So if I look at the evaluation of a map, evaluation map of a knot now, it now has, when I compactify, it has domain, the sort of blown up simplex, and it has range, this compactified version of configurations in M. But there's another property of this evaluation map. You don't see all of the strata of this. You only see parts of the strata where, for example, if three points are coming together on the knot, so we have a knot, and if these three points are approaching each other, let's think about that infinitesimal triangle that they approach in the limit. It's not a generic one. It's one of these funny ones with the three points being collinear. Okay? What I'm going to say is that a point in the on the boundary of this compactification is aligned if that collection of points in the infinitesimal configuration is in some sense collinear. The way to say that is that the sort of relative vectors I didn't mention, but one thing you can always recover if these points have crashed together is some sort of tangent vectors at M saying what direction they approached one another. So if those relative vectors are all the same, then of course you're lying on a line, and we call that point aligned. So so the evaluation map maps from the space of embeddings to the space of maps whose image is aligned. Okay? So again, a priori, are there the erasers somewhere here? So a priori, the space of embeddings maps to, sometimes I also call this K of M, the space of knots in M, maps to the space of all maps from this blown up simplex into configurations in M compactified. Can you, is that all right? Okay, good. But again, this doesn't, we still have the problem that this space has the same homotopy type as the target. But inside the maps, we can ask for the ones which are stratum preserving, because the evaluation map has a property that if three times have come together on the knot, then the image in the configuration space will have those three points lying over the same point in M. That's one part. That's part of the functorality of these compactifications. So you look at the stratum preserving knots, and then you look at the aligned stratum preserving knots, and let me call this space the space of aligned maps sub n of M. So the evaluation map maps here, and the theorem is that in high dimensions this map tells you a lot about the homotopy type of the space of knots. Okay, and in low dimensions, in dimension 3, this map is going to tell us about finite type invariants. Okay. So, so what's the statement here? Well, I should tell you the sort of theoretical background that I'm coming from. Goodwillie and his collaborators have created a sort of calculus for functors like embeddings and things. I mean, so first of all, you look at embeddings as not just a construction but a functor, because if you've got an embedding of M into N, you can restrict it to any open set. This is sort of Gromov's point of view. Actually, it goes back to 1970 or something. And you can, in fact, reprove Smale's immersion theorem by sort of taking that point of view and then proving that immersions satisfy Meyer via torus. And Goodwill and his collaborators have generalized the notion of Meyer, Viatoris, and excision to you sort of weaken them, but you can still study the functors which satisfy those weaker conditions, and you call them polynomial. And what polynomial ends up meaning is that it's the sort of best approximation to the space of embeddings that is determined by open subsets in the domain, which are diffeomorphic to a disjoint union of open balls. So somehow you're taking embeddings and you're trying to find the best approximation to that space of embeddings by looking at spaces of embeddings of very silly subsets in the domain, namely open balls. Okay, so their excision work allows you to prove that in some cases this space approximates the space of embeddings remarkably well. In fact, all you need is M is codimension 3 in N, okay, which is actually pretty remarkable. I told Kinsevich about this result, and he was pretty surprised that you'd actually get it for codimension 3. So then where I come in is I sort of took their general machine and I sort of thought about it a bit and noticed that it had something to do with this evaluation map. Okay, so their general machine is sort of giving you the same information that this evaluation map does. So then I can plug into their general machine and say, well, if you've got a codimension 3 embedding, so dimension of M is greater than 3, then this evaluation map tells you all you want to know about the homology and homotopy groups about the spaces of embeddings. So in other words, this evaluation map tells you all you want to know about the space, or if you care about things like homology, of the space of knots in R4, in R5, in CP2, and X7, all those spaces. We can sort of start looking at this space of evaluation maps. It's got sort of natural filtrations on it. We can start looking at the cohomology of those spaces. Okay, so let me tell you, so the knot theorists in the audience can wake up in just a couple minutes, but let me do a couple other applications first. So one thing we do is look at those homology spectral sequences. Really, this is a space of maps from something contractible into a configuration space. So the building blocks for all these spectral sequences involve cohomology and homotopy groups of configuration spaces. Again, as Sergei described yesterday, the cohomology of this is a really beautiful ring. In fact, it's got a nice description. Fred Cohen showed that the homology of these configuration spaces is, if you look at a different model, instead of configurations, if you look at little disks inside Euclidean space, little balls, then this underlies an operad. And the open configuration space doesn't, but another nice property of the compactifications is the compactifications do underlie an operad equivalent to the little disks. So you get a new model of the little disks operad. So the homology is an operad, and it's isomorphic as operads to the Poisson operad. The Poisson operad tells you about algebras which have both a bracket and a multiplication, which are compatible. So that's a beautiful description of the homology of these. There's a notion of Hochschild and homology and cohomology for operads, and the theorem, and this is after Torchin, who proved a similar theorem in his thesis under Vasiliev, that the E2 term of the spectral sequence computing the cohomology of this space, and thus that space, is, after appropriate grading conventions, just the Hochschild homology of that Poisson operad. So that's a really really slick description of what the cohomology of knot spaces are. So, I can tell you more and be more explicit. Let me just say, you can be very explicit about this in terms of chord diagrams and graph cohomology. So the Hochschild homology of this Poisson operad is, depending on your versions of the definitions, but it's weakly equivalent to the graph cohomology complexes. So that's telling you about the cohomology of space of all knots. In this case, in Euclidean space, but the spectral sequences that I write down work for general manifolds. Let's see. And there's still the sort of philosophical question, why should this tell us about cohomology of knots, this Hochschild homology of an operad? It's a funny algebraic answer to get to that geometric question, and we can sort of prove it, but we don't know where it comes from. All right. Let me also then advertise that, unlike Vasiliev's techniques, his techniques go through sort of Spanier-Whitehead duality, which then restrict you to the world of homology and cohomology. These techniques allow you to compute homotopy groups, which are harder, but rational homotopy groups can be easier. And one of my collaborators, Kevin Scannell, and I wrote down these spectral sequences. Here's the spectral sequence for knots in R4. We did a lot of these computations. We did the computations through here by hand, and then these are by computer. And one theorem we proved is that, well, this is a spectral sequence that you're not going to get anything for free, because the Euler characteristic of each row is zero. So what happens in some cases is that the row vanishes entirely. In other cases, it doesn't. But notice that we do have some classes down here which can't support higher differentials, because the differentials go, the differential for this goes here, then here, then here. So these might support a differential. But all of these classes are staying. So in particular, this means that there is a two spheres worth of knots in R4, which does not extend to a three balls worth of knots in R4. So that's a very concrete geometric phenomena. We haven't been able to name that two sphere of knots in R4. It's an open question as to what that looks like, and then what these other classes are looking like. But it's been a fun project. Okay, so now the geometric topologists can wake up. For knot theory, the machinery of Goodwillie, Klein, and Weiss doesn't tell you anything about this map. If we knew it were a homotopy equivalence, that would say that we could understand everything about knot theory by understanding that, or if we knew it were a bijection even on pi 0. So it's, I guess, kind of... it might be a good thing that doesn't tell us everything about knots, but we don't know whether it tells us everything. You can still, though, pull back cohomology classes in here to here, or conversely, you can look at components here or try to enumerate components here and understand how that works. If I had a good handle on the components of this space, I could define knot invariance by taking a knot and understanding which component over here they went to. A nice result which says that this general theory, which works so well for high-dimensional manifolds, actually works pretty well for classical knots, too. Ismar Volich, who's finishing his thesis this year with Goodwillie, proved that all rational finite-type invariants are pulled back from these knots, these spaces. So the knot invariants that you get by looking at the components, what this map does on components, are at least as good as rational finite-type invariants. He does this by defining versions of Bott-Taub integrals on these spaces, and then sort of the map from the space of knots to the chord diagrams that you get by Bott-Taub's integrals factors through. So this leaves open some questions. Is there anything more pulled back? Are we getting more than finite-type theory, what about, and other questions are, that's a rational result, which is where finite type knot invariants are understood the best, through the Kinsevich integral and constructions like that. Might we get some integral results, and might we get some alternatives to construction via the Kinsevich integral, which is, the Kinsevich integral is one of those constructions that is far from classical in flavor. The answer is starting to be yes. Okay, so I'm going to use my copy of A3 here. If I've got a knot, I can just ask a simple question: where does a knot intersect a line in three points? So we know that any two points on the knot are on some line. Let's ask the simple question, what about 3 points on the knot? Are there 3 points which intersect in a line? Well, there's simple general position and dimension counting, which you can do, which says that, all right, well, 2 points on the line is sort of no condition whatsoever. To have the third point on the line, well, to have a point in 3-space on a particular line is a codimension 2 condition. So in looking at where a knot hits a line in 3 points, in 3 times, that's a codimension 2 condition, which means that the collection of all such points will be a codimension 2 submanifold of this space here. Once you do some transversality and general position results. Okay? So we've got some 1 manifolds in here defined by collinearity. Okay? And they might have boundary. Okay, in fact, they often do. What would the boundary case be? Here's a boundary case, potentially, where the knot has a tangency that then hits the line in a third point. That would be a boundary point for these collinearity submanifolds. Okay? Well, the collinearity submanifolds come in 3 flavors depending on, you know, here's f of t1, f of t2, and f of t3. And notice that f of t3 ended up being in the middle of f of t1 and f of t2. So there's sort of a permutation there to keep track of. So let's COI be the collinearity submanifold where I is in the middle. Okay? Well, the claim is, let's ignore CO2. It's a little bit degenerate, and we don't want any greenhouse gases in here anyways. So then you've got CO1 and CO3. CO1, if we think about where it has boundary, it cannot have boundary when... So the faces here are labeled by things like, here's, say, the T1 equals 0 face. Okay, this is configurations of 3 times, so one face is T1 equals 0. Another, the big faces are labeled T1 equals 0, T1 equals T2, T2 equals T3, or T3 equals 1. Well, if T1 equals 0, that means F of T1 is up here. Generically, it can't end up between T2 and T3. So CO1 does not have boundary on this face, but CO3 might. Okay. Similarly, if T1 equals T2, then F of T3 can end up between those two. Right? So CO3 cannot have boundary on this face, but CO1 can, because you can have a tangency there. With sort of 2 going to 1, and then sort of pointing at 3. So in fact, CO1 and CO3 have boundaries only on the principal faces, the biggest pentagons in this picture. And CO1 has boundary on 2 of them, and CO3 has boundary on the 2 other. And then what you can do then is define a linking number. So in general, you have problems with linking number and manifolds with boundary. But if the boundary are on sort of disjoint pieces of the manifold, if the boundary of the submanifolds are on disjoint pieces of the boundary of the ambient manifold, then there is a well-defined linking number, and you get a non-invariant that way. Okay? And the resulting non-invariant is of finite type 2, and thus is in fact equal to the coefficient of z squared in the Alexander polynomial. So it is the sort of generating degree, finite type, you know, Vasiliev degree 2 non-invariant. So this is sort of the new perspective on self-linking. You're not looking at linking of the manifolds. You're looking at linking of something in, think of this as parameter space for the manifold. Usually you think of manifolds as parameterized by an interval, but you can parameterize it by a simplex, letting all of the points, all of the coordinates sort of run over the knot. And you're measuring non-triviality of the knot by some sort of linking in that parameter space of these collinearity submanifolds in this case. One way to compute linking number, and you have to be careful in cases of things with boundary, is, of course, project and count crossings. What happens when you look at a crossing here? That actually corresponds to when a knot hits a line four times. Okay? And generically, those are isolated situations because, again, two points on the knot on some line is codimension 0, 3 points is codimension 2, 4 points is codimension 4. Well, codimension 4 inside some A4 is going to be some finite collection of points. And so what you get is a formula for this coefficient of the Alexander polynomial by counting collinearities of 4 points on the knot. And this is something that Dillon, Thurston, and Dror, Barnotan, etc., sort of looked for. They knew that you could define this first invariant in that way, but they weren't able to get the right count. You actually have to count with pluses and minuses, ones, and zeros, because not all collinearities of 4 points come from crossings in this picture. So it's pretty satisfying that that count we were able to do correctly. We were, in fact, led to that count, not from finite type invariant theory, but essentially by, I mean, really what led me here was a spectral sequence computation. The fact is that this this space, AM3, has a Z's worth of components, and that Z corresponds to pi 3, a part of pi 3 of S2 wedge S2. Well, pi 3 of S2 wedge S2, the factor that I'm talking about is the sort of Whitehead product of the two classes here, which is detected by a linking number. And so that linking number got me thinking about these collinearity submanifolds and this interpretation. So my collaborators, Ryan Budney, Jim Cohen, and Kevin Scannell, and I are working on generalizations of this. Let me show you that you can... So here's a picture of these collinearity submanifolds for certain presentations of the trefoil and the figure eight. You just sort of look at it. What you want to do is find the collinearities of 4 points first, and that corresponds to a crossing, and then you sort of piece together the endpoints as well. Those correspond to tangencies, etc., and you can piece together the pictures of these collinearity submanifolds. So then the general picture seems to be that you can start with a knot, and the first thing you do is you pass to its evaluation map, and now you're asking a homotopy theoretic question. And so you have historically, again, the algebra and combinatorics of finite type theory have been governed by, von Neumann algebras, Lie algebras, sort of objects that have now been included into topology, but at the time were considered outside of topology. This evaluation map, its combinatorics are governed by algebraic topology. You take that evaluation map up to homotopy, and then a classic thing, because the evaluation map is a map between manifolds, is to look at pre-images of submanifolds in the range, and these are what I call coincidence submanifolds. The next case, actually, will be, conjecturally, looking where 4 points on the knot, instead of where 3 points on the knot are on a line, where 4 points are on a round circle. The key is that a line is determined by 2 points in 3-space, and a round circle is determined by 3 points in 3-space. And so what you could do is call a family of curves type N if there's a unique member of the family through any N points in 3-space. And then you would be looking at places where the knot hits a type N curve in N plus 1 points for these submanifolds. And through a degree theory argument, you're ultimately counting places where the knot hits that type N curve in 2N points. And conjecturally, we might get all finite type invariants by counting such coincidences. But again, the counting, so that's a conjecture, and I hope you don't scoop me on it, but I haven't told you how to count. The counting is by some spectral sequence arguments, which thankfully I haven't told you about. So let me end by saying that, just talking about some of the dreams that some of us have. This evaluation map idea, according to people like Goodwillie and Kuntsevich, even sort of constructions maybe such as Seberg-Witten invariants and so forth might be able to, or these exotic classes which are there and sort of diffeomorphisms of disk relative to their boundary. This evaluation idea might sort of be a way to understand some phenomena which either have only been understood through physics and other constructions or haven't been understood at all, like A of a point. I mean, it's just a hope, but at least, I mean, I at least have people like Goodwillie, Kuntsevich, and Bott who sort of share that hope that this evaluation map idea might tell us a fair amount about topology of manifolds. So I'll end there.
Questions?
Yes.
What about higher dimensional knots?
So again,
strings. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, not. There are again for codimension 3 knots where there isn't any knotting, but you're looking at families. The theory is in principle told to you by the Goodwillie Weiss Klein tower, but you would have to then do some hard work to understand what the geometry of that tower is. And Goodwillie has another student, Brian Munson, who's done that for some embedding questions, potentially has some new emergent results and can maybe see some things even in four-manifold topology. But it hasn't, haven't really unleashed it. And then in codimension 3, like S2, or codimension 2, like S2 and S4, again, the general theory doesn't tell you anything, but you could look at the same models and see what they do tell you. But again, that's open. I mean, we're still working on classical knots, so.
The Goodwillie Klein Weiss results, they give some kind of numbers for how connected the map is?
At each stage, yeah. Yes.
What are those numbers depend on?
They're, in the case of knots, they're just a multiple of the difference. If M is dimension M, it's roughly AMN. That map is N times K minus M minus 3 connected. So M is greater than 3. So it sort of goes up linearly. So those are linear. Those
It's not actually a multiple of the codimension. It's a multiple of the.
Sorry, it is a multiple of the code. It's a multiple of the codimension minus 2, or you know.
Okay.
Yeah, and in general, that's true. It's a multiple of the codimension minus 2.
So this is your spectral sequence that they compute rational chromatography type for the embedding spaces, right?
Yeah, for the space of knots.
Formal.
Don't know.
So this computation doesn't relate to cohomology algebra, this sort of effects there?
Well, it doesn't start with the cohomology algebra, no. I mean, you could look at the cohomology spectral sequence and try to investigate formality of those spaces. Oh, the other thing I should say is the complexes in the spectral sequence are, again, something I saw Kuntsevich define once. I'm not sure why he defined the rows in the spectral sequence. He had some other reason for writing down the same Lie algebras and differentials, but I couldn't understand what he was doing with them. So that formality probably has some consequences that I have no idea about, but...
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank our speaker again.